John 2, 1 to 12, the wedding at Cana. It's one of the best known events in the life of Jesus. Over the centuries, this story has grabbed people's attention. It has stirred their imagination. John is alone among the gospel writers in telling us about it. And I wonder whether he does tell us about it because it had a particular significance for him. Just glance at verse 11 towards the end of our passage here. What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory and his disciples believed in him. We learn in verses 1 and 2 that Jesus and his mother and his disciples have been invited to a wedding at Cana in Galilee. And that means that John himself was there. And by the end of the wedding, in verse 11, his disciples believed in him. This was for John a moment of revelation. He describes it as a sign which reveals Jesus' glory. And that is why he wants us to know and to understand what took place there. His view of Jesus changed at that wedding. And I wonder whether our view of him might change this lunchtime. If you know John's gospel at all, you'll know that he includes seven signs that he collects and he presents like pieces of evidence to us. He's trying to build a case to persuade us of Jesus' identity. And right at the end of his gospel, John 20, verses 30 and 31, he writes, "Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book, but these are written, that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name." Here at the wedding in Cana, the first sign and the one at which his disciples believed him. So this is more than just a dramatic Sunday school story. It's a faith-stirring, it's a commitment-making sort of event. It is showing us the true identity of Jesus Christ and of what life in his name looks like, both now and in the future. So with that in mind, let me take you into the world of a first century wedding for just a few moments. I've got no points for you today or headings or even themes. Instead, I've got two emotions that I want us to connect with, which I think John has in view as he gives this account of these events. And here's the first of them. Jesus covers our shame. Jesus covers our shame. Weddings in the first century were, as they are in many cultures today, large and long. There would be a real community feel to it, and the celebrations would go on for several days. You had to make adequate preparations. However, something has gone wrong at this wedding. It looks on the surface as if the party is in full swing, but behind the scenes, a worrying reality has become clear. The wine has run out, and this party is about to run dry. Weddings don't always go to plan. I was a guest at one memorable wedding where I thought that I was running late. I literally ran up the church steps past the bride on my way into the service. I needn't have hurried, though, because despite the fact that the bride was there standing at the back of church and the groom was sat at the front, we were waiting a full 30 or 40 minutes for the best man to turn up. Luckily, when he did, he had remembered to bring the rings with him, but it was touch and go for a while. Weddings don't always go to plan. Wedding receptions don't always go to plan either. Well, look, in the grand scheme of things, running out of wine at a party might not seem like a huge deal, but we've got to remember that the culture of Jesus' day was a culture that was shaped by feelings of honor and of shame. Weddings were community events. It was important for your personal and for your family's reputation that things went well. You wanted to provide enough to be generous to those whom you'd invited. It's a good and an honorable thing to be generous to your guests at a party. To run out of wine, to be stingy towards your guests, well, that would be a dishonorable thing. It would bring shame. And so more is at stake here for this bridegroom than the premature end to the party that he had planned. That's why Mary gets involved. She goes to Jesus and tells him the problem. Verse 3, they have no more wine. And Jesus' response in verse 4, we've got to be careful not to mishear it. In our translations, it can come across as rude, dismissive, perhaps even misogynistic. Woman, why do you involve me? I don't think that's the tone of it. The scholars remind us that the word woman there, it isn't disrespectful. It's just a term that's hard to translate well into English. Some of the modern paraphrases have things like, dear mother, something like that. The crucial thing for us in verse 4, though, it comes at the end. Why do you involve me? My hour has not yet come. This is Jesus beginning a great theme of John's gospel, his hour, his time, the central moment of history, the moment for which he came into the world. And he's saying it's not time, not just yet. His hour, we'll later learn, will come as he is lifted up on the cross, as he bleeds and as he dies for the sake of his people. That's his hour. But saying that it has not yet come, what Jesus is really saying is that this sign is a sign of that. He's pointing us towards that event. We must make sure not to miss it. There are some details here that show something of what Jesus is intending for the future, that show us the significance of this sign. You know the story. Jesus sees six stone water jars. He has his servants fill them with water, then draw some out, take it to the master of the banquet, and by the time he drinks it, the water has been turned into wine. It is worth saying, this is a miracle. This is Jesus doing something that only God can do, changing elements, working in the world in a supernatural way. The reason John thinks this is remarkable is that something miraculous has happened. But it's more than just the miracle. It's the significance of the details here that I want us to pay attention to. Notice the extra detail about those stone jars. They are, verse 6, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing. Symbolically, as evidence of sin and guilt, the Jews of the day would wash themselves as a symbol of purification. Next week and the week after, we'll hear Jesus teach about sin, about the reality of sin, about the problem of sin, and about how he saves us from sin. Here in particular, it's one consequence of sin that Jesus is addressing. By using these ceremonial purification jars to deal with this man's problem, Jesus is showing that just as he cleanses us from our sin, so he covers our shame before God, the shame that this man was facing among his family and his community. That's what Jesus is in the business of dealing with for us. Remember Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, having eaten that forbidden fruit. They're exposed and they're naked and they feel shame, and the Lord clothes them there with the skin of an animal. Well, here the Lord Jesus covers the shame of this bridegroom, supplying what he was lacking. Often for us, it's not just the knowledge of our sin in the abstract that is a challenge for us to deal with. Often it's the shame that goes with it that is difficult for us to handle. Whether it's our ill discipline, our anger, our lust, whatever. Sometimes, even if we feel that shame ourselves, when others find out about it, it really hits home to us. And always and forever, we stand exposed before a holy God who knows the secrets of our hearts. Well, Jesus comes to cleanse our sin and to cover our shame. This sign points to that. Jesus covers our shame. But secondly, and just as significantly for us, Jesus provides our joy. Jesus provides our joy. Now, there are two more details from this account that we ought to notice as we draw some final conclusions from it. Notice in verse 6 the quantity of wine that Jesus provides. six jars here of roughly 100 litres each. I make that about 450 bottles. Now, that is either a very big party or it is a huge amount of wine. And I've got to ask you this lunchtime, does this Jesus meet with your expectations? When you think of Jesus, do you imagine him as some kind of party pooper? Do you think of him as a cosmic killjoy? Many people make that assumption about Jesus. Many people think that Jesus is more likely to turn up at your party and turn your wine into water. But Jesus does it the other way round. The Jesus of the Bible, well, he is the Jesus of abundant generosity. He's the Jesus of celebration, the Jesus of joy. Now, we've got to get the right picture here and not the wrong one. This isn't a license for drunkenness, for immorality, for debauchery. Jesus himself has plenty to say about the danger of alcohol and about the sin of overindulging in it. What Jesus is doing, though, is picking up on a great theme of the Old Testament prophets and showing that their promises are fulfilled in him. Isaiah 25, verse 6 and following, gives an illustration of what it will be like when God comes in power to rescue his people. Listen to what the prophet says. On this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. On this mountain, he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all people, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. He will remove his people's disgrace from all the earth. The Lord has spoken. What will it look like when the Lord moves to bring his people back to himself to establish their home with him? The finest of wines, a feast with the richest of food, and the Lord himself removing his people's disgrace, covering their shame, wiping the tears from their faces, swallowing up death forever. The wine is just a trailer for so much more, for something greater and bigger yet to come. It's a picture of a filling, a generosity of giving, the restoration of all things. As my colleague Rico Tice puts it, on that day, there will be no more handkerchiefs, no more hospitals, no more hearses. That's what Jesus is talking about as he turns water into wine. That great day in the future. Jesus is not naive about the challenge of living in a fallen world now. He is one who knows sadness himself. He faced temptation alone in the wilderness. He wept at the tomb of his friend. He was rejected. He was beaten. He was betrayed. He was even crucified for charges that he was innocent of. But this first sign here, this sign invites us to cast our eyes above and beyond the challenges and the struggles and the setbacks of our present experience of life in this world. It is a great promise of a joy-filled future to come, of a party, of a feast, of abundant provision, and of restoration of what was lost as the effects of sin polluted the world. There's a wonderful moment in the final book of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, Tolkien's classic fantasy adventure. I don't think I'm giving away any spoilers. If you haven't read the books yet, they have been out for as long as my dad's been alive, so I think you've had equal opportunity to browse them. Evil corrupts the world. It looks as if all is lost, and then, against the odds, the world is saved. And right at the very end, when everything has come good again, Frodo's loyal sidekick, Sam, wakes up and he asks the good wizard Gandalf to fill him in on what's happened. Sam says this, "Gandalf, I thought you were dead, but then I thought I was dead myself. Is everything sad going to come untrue? What's happened to the world?" Gandalf replies, "A great shadow has departed." And then we're told he laughed, and the sound was like music or water in a parched land. And then Sam goes on. He says, "I feel like spring after winter and sun on the leaves and like trumpets and harps and all the songs I have ever heard." That is what Jesus came to do for you and for me. Everything sad to come untrue. For parched and dry and damaged world that we live in to bring an overwhelming abundance, the finest of wine, a sign and a symbol for life in his kingdom that is full of whatever is lost without him. The burden and weight of our guilt and our shame taken away and covered over. The troubles and trials of life redeemed and restored, replaced with joy. The comedian Milton Jones said this about heaven. Obviously, I don't know exactly what heaven will be like, but all I can say is I wouldn't want to be John Lennon. But then more presciently and more biblically, he says this, "I think heaven will be like coming home to a surprise party after a bad day." This story of Jesus here, water turned into wine, well, it's a bit like the trailer that gives you an indication, an outline, but not the full picture of what the real thing will be like. Every year at school, I had to go to our prize giving, and we would sit there and for what seemed like hours have to clap endlessly as people went to go and shake hands with whoever was handing over their gifts and their prizes. And then the head teacher would give a speech, and he would say everything wonderful about the school. But every year he would end it with these words. He would always say, "This is a great school, but the best is yet to come." And I wonder if that's what Jesus is doing here as he turns water into wine at a wedding that has gone wrong. He's saying, well, this is a good party here and now with me. This is what I've come to bring, but the best is yet to come. So let me leave you with a question. Is that what you think Jesus is all about? Can I say to you, if that isn't your view of Jesus, of who he is and of what he came to do, I wonder if you know the real Jesus. And I'd invite you, I'd challenge you, maybe in these days or weeks ahead, maybe come and talk to me or to Ian, take a closer look. Come and know this joy, life in this kingdom, for yourself. Amen.